second city of Lar with its very narrow streets with your big vehicles, and you are going to be running around in those big vehicles. You'll block our streets. Our traffic will not be able to move. You will move in with your tanks. And I had to interrupt that. Sorry, Brooker, Dr. Brooker, we don't have tanks.
Yeah.
He said, no, I mean your big vehicles, your big trucks.
Yeah.
Oh, and he even went so far as to say, and we know that you have a high crime rate. We will, our daughters will be raped. Oh, dear God, it was terrible. Anyway, all right. We'll have to handle this, because if you feel this way, my goodness, what about the public? And he said, that's who I'm speaking for. Well, again, to cut a long story short, we set up a very narrow streets with your big vehicles, and you are going to be running around in those big vehicles. You'll block our streets. Our traffic will not be able to move. You will move in with your tanks. And I had to interrupt that. Sorry, Brooker, Dr. Brooker, we don't have tanks.
Yeah.
He said, no, I mean your big vehicles, your big trucks.
Yeah.
Oh, and he even went so far as to say, we know that you have a high crime rate. We will, our daughters will be raped. Oh, dear God, it was terrible. Anyway, well, I said, all right, we'll have to handle this, because if you feel this way, my goodness, what about the public? And he said, that's who I'm speaking for. Well, again, to cut a long story short, we set up a committee, a joint committee, that met once a week. And the wing CO, who had been at Marvel and came down to Lar, the wing CO was the chairman, was the head of the Canadian delegation on this committee, and Dr. Brooker, he sat as the chairman or the head of the German committee, if you will, representing the city. And they met once a week. And most of the problems initially came up on the German side. It was quite amazing. Small things that would never have come to our attention if we hadn't had that damn committee going. And, of course, most of them, the CEO was able to say, hell, where's my phone? You know, bang, and it was done. Just like that. It was corrected, taken care of. And, of course, with that, the Germans then did 180, a complete 180. And instead of it being a confrontation every time they met, as it had been the first two or three meetings, it became a meeting of, now, how can we help each other? And what can we do? And that feeling then built and built and built until Lar was twinned with a town just outside Trenton, in Ontario. They're now twinned.
Yeah.
We even had students come from their schools on an exchange basis with the schools in Canada, one-year exchanges. The boy lived with a family, and vice versa.
Yeah.
We did things in the city, in the park. We'd help in the contribution to do something, which would improve the image. If any bands came over, we'd always have a big band concert, public band concert, and the Germans love a band. And of course, our bands were superb, and they didn't have that much of an opportunity to hear a big band. That is a 75, 80-piece band. Yeah. Their bands were more of the factory type of band.
That's right.
Well, again, it all went absolutely beautiful. We had our hiccups. The first real trial came when... the first real test of this camaraderie that had been developed was when the first really nasty accident happened. That was when an airman killed a citizen. He was boiled, and driving through town, and he lost control of the car, and it went up on the sidewalk and killed a civilian. Well, under the NATO status of forces, of course, we handled all our own, both civil and military disciplinary cases. So this was a question of a court-martial, naturally, from where we sat, it was a court-martial. This boy was charged with manslaughter and impaired driving. Well, of course, all of a sudden, the freeze, of course, took place. Because this, as I say, was here we were, the first real test. And the Oberbürgermeister was so annoyed and so incensed at this, that just this terrible accident, and rightly so, it was the thing that he had feared the most, and it had happened. He wanted the lad to be tried by German court, and so, of course, right away, quick, I had to get... He was a lawyer, too, and I said, I'm sorry, doctor, but this is different task forces, and we will do it ourselves. Well, the next week's meeting, it came up again, and the CEO of the wing phoned me and said, boy, this is tough. How about if we have an open court? We invite the press to come, that is the German press, and we'll ask the Oberbürgermeister, the town, to send lawyers or who are their own legal people, whoever they like. I said, God, if that will solve it, yes, we'll have an open court and that's it. Well, we did, and the court was held, and we opened it to the public, and a lot of the Germans came. The press came. The press were there because the German press, because this it had blown up as quite a political thing locally. And I sat there with my fingers crossed because I wasn't too sure whether there were any extenuating circumstances or not. But the court heard the whole thing. It was court-martial, and the boy was sentenced to 2 years as a result of this. 2 years in the jug. And there were extenuating circumstances. I've painted it as all one side. It wasn't quite all one side. There were some extenuating circumstances. But nevertheless, he got 2 years. Well, the reaction of the Germans after that was just unbelievable. They were convinced that he was going to get off. You see, that we, because we were doing the trial, nothing would happen. And I saw the doctor, Dr. Oberbürgermeister, and his opening comment was, before even saying hello, he said, your court was harder on that airman than we would have been if we had tried him in Germany, in our own courts. And so he said, I think everything's going to be all right. And it was. It really was. To the point where and we had another one come up about 2 weeks later. This time it was an officer driving home on a pitched black night it was raining, and an old woman staggered out onto the road, and he hit her and killed her right on the spot. And she was an old, old woman. So there we were, right back again to square one. And I said to the Dr. Oberberg, I said, we'll handle it exactly the same way. We'll have an open court, and cut along the press and everything. We did, except in this case, it was proven. The defense did a good job, the people who were defending this officer. They found that this gal was boiled to the eyebrows. She had just come from one of the guest houses. She had almost been killed several times before, staggering out onto the road, literally almost waving at the traffic to stop because she wanted to list. But so boiled she could hardly stand. Yeah. So as a result, he was exonerated. And again the papers came out and said, and they explained, they took the Canadian side in explaining it to the German people. That this was not a matter of the Canadian courts looking after their own. It was truly the case, and they themselves had done a little digging and even came up with more stuff about this woman than our defending people had been able to come. So it was explained, and of course, again, our relationship with all the villages in the area and so forth was just great as a result of this rapport, and that continued so that. When I left, God, the city gave my wife and I a wonderful farewell dinner, and Dr. Brooker, both in English and in German, recounted those early days. And he then expressed his fears, his deep concern, which I had only been on the edge of, and for the first time, I suppose, really appreciated just how badly and deeply he was worried about the Canadians. And how, over a period of a short, literally, what would be about 18 months, how we had turned the whole thing around. And we were now really working together in every respect. And it was just a magnificent talk. Well, that was fine. I had a letter from Dr. Brooker just the other day with a special... received this special... scroll commemorating the 10th anniversary of the Canadians in Lahr, put out by the city of Lahr, signed by the Oberburgermeister, who was still Dr. Brucker, by the way.
Oh.
And with all the nice words about the relationship between Canada and Germany and the Canadians at Lahr and the citizens of Lahr and so forth. And they had a big ceremony in Lahr to celebrate this between the Germans and the Canadians. And I just happened to, he just sent one to me, being the first AOC in Germany and having helped set this all this up that, to help get the thing on the road.
Mm.
The relationship, and it still is very, very good. The system still works, and now, of course, I think the people of Lahr look on the Canadians as they did the French, when the French pulled out. But it was just about, of course, the next level up was the province, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and the Minister-President of Baden-Württemberg, which was a province. His office was in Stuttgart. And we had quite a good relationship, too, with him, because certain matters were not were beyond the Oberbürgermeister's powers, and they involved the province, just like our own organization, civic and provincial. So we did have certain dealings on properties, things we wanted to do, which legally were in his sphere. So I had contact with him, and that led to several social contacts. He would invite us up to a dinner or a luncheon, and I would invite him down to Lahr to a luncheon and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was a very, very good relationship, and it worked extremely well.
Can I ask you a question here? When you moved up to Lahr, did your headquarters move up at the same time?
Yes.
Well, what about you yourself and your family?
What I did... Oh, the French... just to add to the problems, the officers' mess, we approached the CO. Oh, then you've just... Another rather interesting anecdote. The CO was a colonel.
What CO is this?
This is the French CO. Oh. The French CO at Lahr on the airbase was a colonel. And he also partially controlled the mess. And we asked if we could have our officers who were there in their initial move without families. I moved down without my family initially to get the headquarters set up. And it was about 3 months before actually the family came down. I asked if we could use the mess, and we would even put people in the mess if needs be, that is staff and cooks and whatever, and got a very blunt no from the French, the excuse being that they did their catering on a daily basis. Literally, the sergeant in charge of the mess went down to the market and bought the food that day that was going to be served for the meals during that day. And it would be too awkward for him, with a larger number of people, not knowing who was going to be there and who was not going to be there and how they would pay for it. In other words, built-in resistance. And thus, we couldn't even eat in the mess. We had to eat out. Every meal had to be taken outside the mess. And as far as accommodation was concerned, there were several VIP rooms in the mess. And the general did condescend to let myself and my chief of staff and my EA and my PA use rooms in the mess. Although all the mess was empty, literally the French were not using them, there must have been accommodation for 50 officers, and the rooms were all empty. Those, only the four of us, were allowed to live in these quarters. The site, this was the French at this caserne, the mess was in a beautiful site. It was on the side of a hill, and literally you walk up the hill a kilometer and you're in the Black Forest, right in the Black Forest. But it was high enough that you could look across the city, or the town of Lahr, not really the city, I suppose, but the town of Lahr. And with the verandas, it was big, big windows. It was a beautiful mess. Well, we lived there. And that then became, that was where I slept. We ate out. Every meal had to be eaten out. So that was a bind, because it was question of keeping receipts for meals because we had to claim for them and all that sort of nonsense. The bookkeeping side alone was terrible. And we started to operate in a building. We had been given some office space that there was enough to begin to put an ops room in, and it was only a makeshift ops room. The greatest problem was communications, of course, because our communications had to have all these secure communications, and oh, dear God, it was dreadful. But we did it. We did it, and it worked. We ran our first exercise. The first exercise we ran, I remember we set up a little ops room in the basement of one of the barrack blocks. And I mean in the basement, literally several rooms, not much bigger than this office. And that was our headquarters. And we ran the whole exercise for 4 days out of those rooms. As far as my own accommodation was concerned, this was one of those perks that... this is one of those perks that doesn't happen very often in a career, and I guess I was indeed very fortunate. But the French, I related the story of the house or the quarters that were provided for General Gautier when outside of Metz and what a palatial place it was. Well, the French always look after their generals, and they always have. And there was a house that they had built using reparation funds, a house they had built in Lahr, up on the side of the hill. Lahr, not a big place, but it is in a valley. Mm-hmm. And the hills go up, and my house was on the side of the hill, and just above me were all vineyards, because it's a great, great, great area.
Is it?
Yes, and lots of vino. Weisswein.
Oh,
good
one.
This house on the side of the hill and up near these vineyards, lovely view. It had a magnificent patio leading off the dining room and one of the lounges. It was a big house. It had over 5,000 square feet in it.
Oh.
And formal gardens.
Oh, my.
So here am I. I'm entitled to a maid or a gal to look after the house as on the establishment, and that's it. And I found that the French general, had a staff of 10 in this place. And, of course, we must remember that the French still had conscription at this time.
Yeah.
So that there were many conscriptees who never really did do anything but what their profession was. And that's why they always had such good chefs, good cooks. And the general, by God, was made bloody sure that he had the best chef in his whole bloody outfit. It would be a chef. It would be a chef who had to do his 2 years.
Yeah.
For his country, for flag and country, and the general would grab him and he'd operate in the kitchen. And I know for a fact that the general's wife didn't, in the years that they were there, didn't look at a single menu. They would have dinner parties and she would have no idea what was being served until she sat down and then the staff would serve. But the house was built with the reparation funds and furnished with reparation funds. Now it was completely furnished. For example, the dining room. Beautiful, great big dining room. We could seat 24 at the table.
Well, and all of this came to you.
All this came to me,
including the furniture.
Well, it almost did. This was what was in the house, because I went in to see it. Finally, when I got down, and the general was going to be moving out. He was going to be moving out in about 3 days, and I finally got through to see him, and allowed to go into the house. Mm-hmm. And my eyes were popping. Because, for example, I mentioned the dining room. Well, there was flatware, crystal, plates, everything for 24. The bedrooms, all completely furnished. The linen was there, down to the towels, to the face cloths. The house was completely and utterly furnished. We could move in there, and all you would probably need would be your own personal little alarm clock, and you could live. It was that well furnished with reparation funds. Well... I was delighted because the furniture that we had in Metz, and which had been there for the 10 years, was in dreadful shape. Mm-hmm. It was cheap, cheap stuff to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I had thought, God, I wonder if I could get authority to buy some decent furniture for the AOC's house, because it, wherever that might be, not knowing what it was going to be, because this stuff isn't going to last the move, much less use it again after a move. Oh, terrible condition. And of course, I should also add that all the other PMQs were also furnished with reparation funds. So there was a fair amount of stuff left around. Yeah. Well, I again heard through the grapevine that the general was going to ship all of that stuff back home. Just gut the place. And God, in a panic, I thought, my goodness, what do I do? Because there was no way I could either get the money to furnish it or bring it up to the standard that was there. Beautiful carpets, chandeliers, the whole nine yards. And we'd seen what they had done to some of the bark blocks, and I knew what that house was going to look like if he didn't move out. Well, I had prayed a thing I forgot to mention was that Massu moved from Metz just before we moved out. He moved to be the commander-in-chief of French forces in Germany. And his headquarters was at Baden-Baden. And so, of course, as soon as I arrived down there, I went and paid a protocol visit to Massu. And bless him, you would have thought I was a king. He turned on a review that you wouldn't believe. God, he had troops doing march pass. He must have had a couple of thousand troops out and prayed that all I'm doing is making a protocol visit on General Massu, the commander-in-chief of French forces in Germany, at Baden-Baden. Well, we had a discussion afterwards, stayed for lunch, formal luncheon, and then a meeting in his office. And he had a chief of staff. Now, his chief of staff was a major general. The name's gone for a minute. But a very interesting man himself. He had been an attaché in Washington for many, many years. He'd been an attaché in London for many, many years. Spoke with the most beautiful Oxford accent you've ever heard. You would never know he was a Frenchman. No way. He hadn't been in uniform. And he was the one, in the book, the novel of the group who were planning to assassinate de Gaulle. Name will come to me.
The one that's been made into a movie?
Yes. It's a stone, isn't it?
I know the one you mean.
In this book, de Gaulle sends a colonel to investigate everything in Washington, and it was this same officer. So he was a terribly interesting man, but that I'm digressing. In our little talk, I was making my farewell to go back down to Lar, Massu said, now, look, if there's... He knew the problem that I was having down there. And he said, now, remember, I own everything that's French in Germany. And if you have any troubles, you let me know, or let my chief of staff know. He said, let my chief of staff know, because he spoke English. Well, I remembered this conversation when this business of the house came up, because up until then, I wasn't too disturbed about what was going on. But I phoned the general, and I said, God damn it, I'm appealing to you and to General Massu and taking him up on his offer of help and assistance, because I need it. Then I explained to him what was going on, that they were moving all the furniture out, at least planning to move the furniture out of the court, out of the this house. And the colonels probably would be doing the same thing. And I thought, gee, these people are representing, the CO's got to have a house so he can invite the local people in. He'll be doing official entertaining and so forth. And God damn it, we need that furniture because our stuff just doesn't fit. And he said, leave it with me. He said, I'll call you tomorrow. And he then called back tomorrow and he said, I've been on to Paris. And he said, very simply, these are reparation things and by law we're not allowed to take them out of France. And I said, wow, great. I said, but he's now almost at the state of moving. And he said, don't worry about it. The general is going to phone him. And I'd just love to have heard that conversation. My. Well, not only was that stopped, but all the other stuff that they were shipping out and people were glomming on to was stopped immediately, too. Unbeknownst to, we didn't know the law to that extent, you see. We thought that this they were literally like ex-infrastructure. They were taking stuff back. Well, as a result, the general, who I never saw again, that is the general in Lar, never saw him again, he literally walked out of the house with a couple of suitcases, and that was it. Instead of taking all the stuff, and that was more. By God, they did an inventory check before he left, which was an interesting thing as well. And that was great.
I'll be damned.
Just great. And so that, again, that relationship, which was established in Metz with General Massu, really came to the fore during that time when we felt we were going to be left with nothing but some shells. So that everything was handled properly from there on. The French moved out. They moved out quickly. I guess Massu must have leaned a wee bit, too. And he said, you've got to... We're getting a bad name. You get cracking. And everything from there on went very, very smoothly, quickly, and it was great. And again, from there on, we had Massu down with 1st of July, which was 1967, 1st of July. Our first... Dominion Day or Canada Day in Germany. We couldn't use the mess. Couldn't use the mess. So we went through our liaison officers to the general and said, well, if we can't use the mess, can we use the lawns? Well, the lawns by this time were about 18 inches high in grass. And the French said, oh, no, you can't use the lawns. And they were lovely lawns around the mess. We wondered why they never cut the grass. So we said, well, we'll cut the grass. Don't worry about if there's any problem. We'll do that. He said, oh, no, it's not that. We sell the grass. That is a crop.
Oh,
and until the crop is ready, I'm afraid we cannot cut it. And we said, well, look, what's it worth? We'll pay for the darn grass. We'll cut it. We've got to have a place for it. Well, long story short, the French finally let us use the lawn. They wouldn't let us use the mess, but they let us use the lawns. And we invited the two princes of Baden, the nephews of Prince Philip. We invited the Minister-President, Massu, the local Germans, the Oberbürgermeister, the Minister-President. We had all the French dignitaries, German dignitaries we get hold of, including Massu. And Massu was extremely well-liked by all these people, too, because, well, he was that kind of man. Well, they came, and we had a big cake made by one of our cooks of Canada with all the provinces on it and the centennial year and all this sort of great fall in love. We served champagne like it was going out of style. I still wonder how the hell we got all the money together because it's all non-public funds. There was no money from Canada to help pay for this party. Well, it went over beautifully. And I got Massu and... who the hell was it? Massu and somebody else to jointly, with a great big saber, cut the cake, so to speak. And I had the opportunity to again say to Massu the difficulty here we were. We couldn't even go in the mess. As a matter of fact, the only thing we could do in going in the mess now would be to have a pee. And I let him know that he didn't forget. And boy, Massu was now a 5-star general. In other words, he was a full general, commander in chief. And when he said move, French, they moved. No nonsense about it, they moved. And he took that word back, and again, things began to work. And it was, if we hadn't had that experience with Massu in Metz, it would have been quite a different story, sure. But it was magnificent. We visited him many times. When he left, he came to a big, we had a big farewell for him when he finally went back to France. And he was being retired, and we presented him with a great big Eskimo carving, and again, all non-public funds. And the rascal, if he didn't forgive to Barbara and me, a beautiful set of silver fighting cocks, but from his
beautiful.
Own personal things that he brought back from the Far East or something like this,
lovely.
You know. And it just, you almost don't know quite what to do with some of the stuff, the things that happen.
Well, tell me, Reg, how do you account for this bitchiness on the part of the French?
Oh, yeah, I forgot to. I said I was going to digress and tell you about a colonel. The French Air Force did not want to move back to France because they were, and as far as they were concerned, they were overseas, and they had all the perks of overseas troops. They had their own PX where they could buy stuff, butter. For example, butter was, you couldn't get butter in France. I mean, what you could get was terribly expensive. In their own grocery store in Germany, they could buy all the butter they wanted. Tons of it. But they couldn't take it in. If they took more than 1 pound and when they went across the border, they were smuggling. So there were a multitude of reasons why the... It wasn't the French army that was moving back.
Yeah.
It was the France decided to leave the French army in Germany to protect the Rhine.
Yeah.
Really, from their strategic logic was it was to protect the Rhine. And that's why they had a couple of divisions spread up and down that part of Germany. But the Air Force had to go back to fill up this void that had been left by the Americans on these airfields.
Yeah.
Well, this colonel, who worked with the CO of one wing, also a colonel, they would get together and this colonel would say, "We are not going back to France. I don't give a damn what de Gaulle says. We are not going back to France. And you cannot have that building. You cannot go into that hangar. We are not moving." And, God, there was... Christie was the there was Bob Christie having conniption fits. And he came and he said, "What the hell do I do? Here's this colonel who's countermanding every order that he's getting down the net from his people." Well, it was dreadful, and this man was almost so excited that one time he almost threatened to assassinate de Gaulle for moving the French Air Force out. So they just didn't want to move, and they had a colonel who stood up in public in front of Germans and everyone else and said, at a little ceremony, he said, "We are not moving." He said, "I don't know what you Canadians are going to do, but we are not moving." My God, it was grim. But anyway, that was why everybody was dragging their feet. They were hoping and praying that de Gaulle was going to reverse his decision to keep the Air Force in Germany. But fortunately for us, he never did. I don't know what the hell we would have done. It really would have been chaos if he had.
Yeah.
Good.
So that relationship with Massu was great, and it continued right up to the time, and then he was replaced, and we were able to use some of their training areas. There was a very, very fine relationship continued. We allowed the French to use our PX.
Yeah.
We were allowed to use their grocery stores, which was great because they always had lots of wine in their stores, which we get at their rates, you see, the overseas rates.
Yeah.
Again, a little story. This butter incident at Baden-Solingen, which was, of course, our nearest base for them, they would come in droves on a Saturday, and they would literally clean the place out of butter. But they always wanted unsalted butter. And most of our stuff was salted.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the CO, "God damn it, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to order a whole pile of unsalted butter." And he did. He brought in tons of unsalted butter. And then the French, of course, as soon as they knew it was unsalted, then they really came in droves. And they'd walk out with 12, 15, 20 pounds at a crack. And he charged them 1 cent more than for the going price for the salted butter, you see, per pound. And he was asked by the French one day why. And he said, "Well, that's the cost of taking the salt out of the butter." And without batting an eye, they nodded their head and picked up the butter and walked out. And so the PX made a little bit of extra money from that 1 cent per pound of butter. But it was good fun. And there was well, those, I guess that's it. Now, I think because I've now, the next bit, of course, is the real political bit, which is our own national politics on nuclear weapons and defense policy.
Yeah.
I've related all these international and local political things because I think they are interesting, and who knows, there may be a lesson there because what looked like real terrible trouble, compoundingly, we had enough problems and troubles as it was. We didn't need any more. We managed through a little organization and a little goodwill, we managed to bring real order out of chaos and a relationship, which, as I say, is still excellent today, and I hope it will continue. But it was touch and go for a while.
Fantastic. Tell me, incidentally, was Mike Pollard over there when you were there?
No. Mike Pollard was in the air division well before I went over. Well before I went over.
I see.
Yes, he was at the base that had been closed in France, Grosetonquin.
Yeah.
How do you spell that, by the way?
G-R-O-S, Grotonquin, T-E-N-Q-U-I-N.
Right.
And it had already closed before I went over. When they went from the F-86s to the 104s, CF-100s and 86s to the 104s, the 104 program was just too expensive to keep 12 squadrons.
Mm-hmm.
So they chopped it back to 9.
Mm-hmm.
Three of them were going to be in the Fort Recchi and 6 in the strike attack. And that was the order of battle when we arrived.
Yeah.
And they'd even had a radar, a very, very good Mark 8 radar. It was the most powerful radar in Europe at the time when Canada bought it and installed it near Metz, not too far away from Metz. But it was used for the Sabres. It was a fighter intercept type of radar. And of course, when we got to the 104s, there was no requirement for the radar. So I forget what happened to it. It was dismantled anyway, in the sense that we didn't need it, and it disappeared off our books. So we were the order of battle really was just the three wings plus a training base down in Sardinia. Because of originally was the Sabres started by going to Algeria, where they could do their firing.
Mm-hmm.
Then that was closed out, and it was moved to Sardinia, which became a NATO base with the Germans, the Italians, and the Canadians,
mm-hmm.
each paying a share. I think we paid a quarter, the Germans paid a half, and the Italians paid a quarter
mm-hmm.
for that.
Probably the Italians bought a quarter.
I'll have to relate stories about the agreement on Detchemont Island because it also is a revelation. But that became our training base, and the squadrons would go down because we had a range down there, and they could do things which was a bit difficult to do over land. Up in they could go supersonic and a few things like that.
Yeah.
But I'll pick that up later.
Right.
Yeah.